Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Guitar, an amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. Good evening, everybody. I'm really honored to have on the show Tarka Kone, an amazing guitar player, also an amazing educator. He's done a lot of different things. I mean, he's probably most famous for being the music director for Josh Groban, but he's played with people like George Duke, Leanne Rimes, Tom Scott, Jennifer Lopez, Whitney Houston, Christina Aguilera. I mean, it goes on and on and on. But we're going to get in some interesting things that he's done as both as a musician and also as an educator, which I think is very important because I'm going to let you explain it all. So welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jeff. Good to see you.
Give us a little background on where you came from, your musical influences, and how you got into guitar.
Oh gosh, you know, it's funny. On the drive down, I was thinking about this. My goal today is to speak slowly because I have a tendency to speak quickly and mumble.
Because you have so much to say.
Yeah, that's what it is. That's what it is. No, I was thinking today. You know, I always feel so odd as a guitar player because I came at it from a very odd standpoint. I wasn't the kind of person that came up playing in a lot of different bands. You and I talked about this at one point before, but my father was an educator, mm-hmm. and I'd kind of been enamored with the idea of playing guitar earlier in life, but it wasn't until I was in high school, and my friend Glenn Phillips, who's an incredible singer and still one of my best friends, and he was the lead singer for Toad the Wet Sprocket and has an incredible mm-hmm. solo career. He was in this band, and he said, you know, maybe if you learn to play guitar better, you know, you can join the band. And for me, that meant girls because, you know, we were equally as nerdy, but he had a girlfriend. So I started kind of taking it seriously, and that actually got me into playing blues and jazz. And I started actually, I went to the Berklee College of Music to educate myself. I actually was at UC San Diego for a couple of years. Started studying contemporary classical and things like that, and then wound up at Berklee and kind of went on this complete path I hadn't expected. And that kind of brought me out in Boston I was working in and kind of brought me out to Los Angeles and really quickly kind of working. I think I was very lucky to move out to Los Angeles in a period in time where you could hit the ground running and you could actually go someplace and meet guys who were on the scene doing things, doing sessions, doing, you know, touring gigs, and very quickly through word of mouth, you know, people started introducing me to, you know, big name people, and I started doing gigs, and it still is a bit of a surprise to me. Like even when I look at the names of people I've played with, I have to remember. I just think I'm very old. I think I've been around long enough to have done these things. So
no, it's not a matter of age. It's just you were very very busy.
Oh, and I was very fortunate, I think, because you know, like I said, I studied at the Berklee College of Music, and I had to leave the Berklee College of Music early, so I wound up kind of going and working in Boston, you know, for lack of a better term, on the streets of Boston, doing club gigs and doing these things, and wound up working with this incredible saxophonist, Walter Beasley. And Walter was this kind of world-renowned jazz saxophonist and an educator at Berkeley. And he started doing a tour based out of Los Angeles, and the guitar player had to leave, who's now a friend of mine, my friend Ray Fuller. And Ray was also, at the time, was the guitar player. He'd worked with Whitney Houston in the past, and George Duke. He was George's kind of guy at the time. And they needed a guitar player, and Walter said, call my guy. And at the time, I must have been, I think 23, 24. He said, call my guy. And is that right? I'm going to say yes. I think I was maybe 24. And he said, call my guy. And it was such an incredible opportunity. And the guys I worked with Kenny Loggins and George Duke and all these different people. So when I did make my way out to L.A., because Gerald Albright was on the tour, and Gerald said, I'm thinking about adding guitar to my band, and that was enough of a reason for me to come out. I came out, and some of the guys in the band worked with George, and suddenly, literally on my answering machine, back when it was tape, there was a message on my machine from the bass player going, Larry Campbell, who said, George Duke's looking for a guitar player. I told him about you. And the next message was George Duke going, Larry Campbell told me about you. You know, are you around? So it was literally, I moved to L.A., and I had thought at the time that I'm going to give myself 5 years, and if I feel like within 5 years I'm able to work with someone like a George Duke, I will have made it. And it was like 6 months after I got into L.A. that I got the call from George, and I said, you know, okay, it was worth the move. It was worth the gamble. So, yeah.
No, that's great. And then, so you never finished. I thought you finished from Berkeley.
No, you know, so this is a running gag for me. I always say they dropped me out. And I tell the story. I do some master classes and stuff. And I actually tell the students that I have no problem talking about my failures as well as my successes. And I wouldn't call it a failure, but those forks in the road. Because for me, those are the moments where you have an opportunity to define yourself. And when you're challenged in that way, you have to make a real strong decision of how you're going to kind of pick yourself up and dust yourself off and whatnot. So I always say it's about the recovery, not the fumble, because we're all going to have those moments. So for me, I went out to Berkeley, and I didn't have the money at the time to continue mm-hmm. to go. And it was at a period in my life where I'd kind of been in Los Angeles, or Santa Barbara, where I'm from, and I felt like I had maxed out my potential in Santa Barbara. I tried to go to the Musicians Institute, mm-hmm. and that didn't work out. And then, for various reasons, when I got to Berkeley, I went for one semester, came home, went back, and my financial aid fell through, and I didn't have the money to stay. And so I had to make a choice of whether I was going to come back to Santa Barbara and lick my wounds or stay in Boston. And I basically told my parents, I'm staying here because, you know, I have to do this. I've got to figure out how to make this work. I've got to. So I wound up getting jobs as a telephone rep and waiting tables. And I was literally just telling the story last night. I was waiting tables so much, I turned around and said, you know, I'm not a guitar player, I'm a waiter. You know, because I was so tired when I get home. Mm-hmm. So I had to make the decision of, you know, I went through this period where I was drinking 4 pots of coffee a day. Where wow. I'd wake up and I would drink a pot of coffee so I could practice before I had to do my shift. You know, and I took the lunch shift so that I could make myself available to work at night, even though it was less money. Mm-hmm. But I'd drink coffee there. Then I'd drink another pot of coffee when I go home to practice. Then I'd go to the clubs and drink a pot of coffee there, wake up and just hit repeat, you know, because I realized if I didn't, I would never be able to do this for a living. You know, I'd never be able to not just be a guitar player, but make a living playing the guitar. And that's all I could dream of doing. Mm-hmm. So I always feel like it's fortunate. I never take it for granted that somehow this piece of wood, you know, has paid for a lot of bills.
Now, besides Berkeley, didn't you study at UC San Diego?
I did. So going back, you know, and I apologize that, you know, the story is not linear. But
that's okay. No. It's interesting because it has an impact on your plan. I mean, that's
it does. And so when I was in Santa Barbara, I never really thought I was going to be a professional musician. I grew up in a small town. I mean, Santa Barbara's now people don't think of it as a small town, but growing up in the 70s and the 80s, you know, it felt very insulated. And even though it's only an hour and a half from Los Angeles, culturally, it's like the moon,
yeah,
you know.
So, different.
Yeah,
it's
you know,
a big small town.
Yeah,
small,
yeah,
small
yes.
town.
Because a little
laid
town.
Back.
And, yeah, it's very, very kind of laid back, and there's a lot of kind of country and Americana and that kind of cultural stuff. And so, for me, guitar was something I did for me. It was something where I felt like there are things I couldn't articulate, you know, and the guitar let me speak in that way. Mm-hmm. And so it was just something that was very private. And I went to UC San Diego to actually be a lawyer. I was down there studying psychology, and then I realized that it wasn't psychology that I loved, but philosophy. And I had an epiphany that, you know, was I going to be a philosopher, or was I going to perhaps teach philosophy? But I always played guitar. And as a quick aside, I remember, you know, I loved guitar so much, I would wake up at like 5 o'clock in the morning before high school and I'd play guitar and practice before going off to school. And my brother, who's 4 years older than me, he had a friend visiting from college, and his friend saw me and he said, "Why are you studying
all the night?"
Well, but he was saying, "Why are you studying anything other than guitar?" He goes, "You know, you obviously want to be a musician." Mm. And he goes, "Even though you're a bright guy, you're going to flunk out if you don't pursue this because, you know, this is your passion." Mm-hmm. Fast forward, I go to UC San Diego and I almost flunk out because all I wanted to do was play guitar. So I decided I needed to figure out a way to pursue it. And so I was just taking a year off to go to MI to see if I had any aptitude. And when that fell through, I was like, let me try Berkeley. And I was just going to take a year to see if I had any aptitude. So when I finally was in that position of making a decision, even though I didn't get the full year, I knew I had to like put all my chips in. You know, I had no backup plan. I was, you know, on a high wire without a net, but I knew that unless it was literally if you don't play, you don't eat, then I wouldn't be putting the kind of energy into it.
Sink or swim.
Yeah. I mean, literally, it was like, you know, there was a very serious period of time where, and I mean, still to this day, I mean, I have no other real marketable skills. You know what I mean? I mean, as you know, I'm an educator, and I've done all these other things, and I've written books and whatnot, but it's not like I'm not going to have a type off. I'm not going to beat anyone. You know,
I mean, I'm just going to mention it right now. You were chairman of the guitar department at the LA College of Music.
That's true.
You've written 10 books.
It's true.
And a pedagogical series called String Theory.
Yep.
I mean, that's pretty good
for a
guy that was dropped out of Berkeley.
It's true. It's true.
Sorry, but that's...
It's true. And I think that, you know, I've always had a real passion for education and for learning. And I think that the guitar especially is such I don't want to call it an enigmatic instrument, but one of the things I love about the guitar, one of the things I love about what you do with this program, is the guitar doesn't just change in the sense that, like, stylistic, let's say you play piano, and you play a different thing if you're playing, let's say, ragtime versus bebop versus, versus pop music and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But the vocabulary changes, but even the role of the guitar changes. Like, if I'm playing like I played last night so in the past 4 days, I was working with Brian McKnight, with just him on piano, and then we were playing as a trio. Then I was playing a fusion jazz show in Mendocino the next night. And then last night I was playing this soul funk gig with a 4-piece horn section. And your role
changes. Herman Matthews.
With Herman and like Brandon Fields and these guys. But I should say everybody if I'm going to say names, but some incredible musician. But your role as a guitar player changes. If I'm playing Led Zeppelin music, it's like my role changes. I've got to expand my role versus playing a smaller role if I'm playing in an 8-piece band or a 12-piece band.
Yeah.
Exactly. So one of the things I love is the difference between playing Robert Johnson and playing Segovia is light years away, and it's the same instrument with relatively the same tuning. So that's one of the things that, for me, the pedagogical part of it, of how do you break it apart? It's still the same 12 notes, so how do you define it? How do you organize information, and then how do you inform that with style? You know, so if everybody plays a G, like one of the things I do in my clinics is I'll write a G on the board, and I say, everybody knows what that is, you know. And if everybody plays a G, is it a jazz G? Is it a rock G? Is it a bebop G? Is it a funk G? Is it a soul G? Like, what informs that? Because it's just that one thing on the board. So you inform it with taste, with experience, with knowledge, with theory, theoretically.
Background.
You know, background and all that stuff. And hopefully you integrate all those things into a style. Like, hopefully you integrate it to where, you know, like you've had some incredible guitar players here, but if you gave Toshi, Basil, you know, Mark Goldenberg, you know, all these guys the same G, they would play it all differently.
Yeah.
You know, and that's part of what's beautiful about not just the guitar, but music in general.
Yeah, well, it's in your hands, so to speak.
Right. Right.
That's 99% of what it is.
That reminds me of what Don Peake was talking about with the three guitarists for the Motown stuff that he was talking
right.
about, where he was, remember he was or playing the, each of the parts. And
well, he played with the Phil Spector's Wall of Sound. He did You Lost That Loving Feeling,
right.
and there was the three guitar players. And that was standard,
yeah.
even with Tommy Tedesco, the three chairs.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's a whole discipline under itself. And it's funny, I know that we have clips to play and whatnot, but and I know that this is going to seem like it's a planned transition, but it's not. But it's funny because I do this gig, this kind of bi-monthly gig now in Ventura at Grapes and Hops.
Mm-hmm.
And it's we call it Groove Lounge, and it's incredible musicians. It's me and, not that I'm incredible, I'm just saying, I'm saying I happen to be there. But it's,
you're
but
the organizer.
Well, yeah, exactly. I've got the band and the PA. So.
He's the musical director.
He heard them, exactly.
Yep. And he makes the flyers.
But it's Kurt Buscara on drums from, you know, who's played with Elton John and Mick Jagger and Bonnie Raitt and all this stuff in the time. And then it's my buddy Mark Stevens on piano, who plays with Larry Carlton and Chaka Khan and Diana Ross and Josh Groban. And my friend Dan Lutz on bass, who's played with everybody. And James Harrow, I couldn't do the last one, and my buddy James Harrow played guitar, who's incredible.
Yeah.
He played with Madonna and Melissa Etheridge and Jewel and all these people. And so I was like, I was kind of jealous. Oh, in fact, the last gig Dan couldn't do, so we called Travis Carlton, Larry's son, who's an incredible bass player.
Oh, Brian Auger's people.
Yeah, right. So Travis came up, and I was like, man, I want to see that show. Like, I couldn't do it. But so I said to James, I'm like, well, let's do one together. And James was like, absolutely. So the next one we're doing together, and that discipline of playing with another guitar player and finding your spot and finding your space and staying in your lane, and it's such a lost art these days. Because now when you're recording, you're overdubbing or, you know, you're just layering parts. But that thing of where do you stand? Like, if you're, when you sit down, you know, who's next to you? Like, I just did a thing at Kennedy Center with Dean Parks. And if you're playing with, if I'm playing with Dean Park, let's say, and
guitar
anybody,
or pedal steel?
Well, he was playing guitar this time, but Dean, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but it's like, for me, I'll always grab book two. I always know that my job is to, I mean, because he's a genius and brilliant and incredible, but also, you know, he is my senior and he's got seniority. Mm-hmm. So I know that my job is to kind of be.
Support
I call
him.
It be Ron Wood. Yeah.
Well, it goes to, because you've played many different things, and we're going to play in a minute a clip of you, like an orchestral setting, and then there's, you know, like with Josh, you've played with full orchestra.
Yeah.
Then you're playing, like, two guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And we've talked about this before, was, you know, how you approach it. A lot of it is you listen, which a lot of musicians and upcoming musicians, you got to listen to what's going on in the band so you know where to put where your space is.
Absolutely. And I think that, so someone said to me recently, they were listening to me play and they said, you are a listening guitarist. And especially on guitar, that's something that's a huge compliment because, you know, we have a bad reputation as guitarists of being so into the guitar that it's like we turn up or we you know, don't stay in our lane and all that stuff. And for me, that's not what music is. Music is meant to be interactive, and it's meant to be a team sport in a lot of ways. So finding not only your space, but, you know, sometimes it's just the smallest thing to move the action forward, you know. And so I'm guilty of a couple of things, one of which is I'm guilty of waiting until everybody, you know, has found their space and then finding a space around it. You know, I rarely kind of want to, you know, force my perspective. You know, I wanna be that team player, and I think one analogy or one story I tell is I was doing Saturday Night Live with Christina Aguilera,
mm-hmm.
and we were doing the song Ain't No Other Man, and I played on the track, you know, and that's when I should have sent you. I played on the track, and you know, I didn't really come in with any guitars until like the second half of the tune, so on the TV show, I'm like waiting. You know, for a whole verse and a whole chorus, and don't even come in until like the second chorus. And my buddy Michael Thompson, who's like my big brother, he called me. He's like,
his name comes up every show, right?
Yeah, like, well,
Michael,
I mean,
we must bring you on the show.
I mean, seriously, he's one of my favorite people and just an incredible guitar player. And probably more than anyone in Los Angeles, took me under his wing and went, "This is what I do."
Yeah.
And this is, and he was like, come over to my house, meet my family, look at my rig, you know, let's go to Gilbert and get some Mexican food. Like, he was really a big brother. Even with David Foster, you know, it was really Michael who said, you know, call Tarek. You know, even though I knew David at the time, he was like, call Tarek. So anyway, so Michael called me and he said, Tarek, he said, I don't know if I could have been that patient just to not play for that long. But for me, that's kind of my nature, is to kind of go, you know, if everybody's going left, I'm going to go right. Or I'm going to do something to hopefully support what that is. So if I have to be bigger, I've got to be bigger. If I've got to be smaller, I have to be smaller. There's no ego. It's a team sport. You know, if I'm playing shortstop or if I'm playing, you know, right field, it doesn't really matter to me. I just want to help the team, and God willing, we'll get the pennant.
Well, it's actually an orchestral approach.
Yeah, right.
Because in the orchestra, not everybody's playing all of the time.
Yeah.
There is tacit.
Right. You know? Well, we call it take it.
Take it.
It's funny. It kind of reminds me of, you know, Steve Postel and the Night Train, because a lot of times he has three great guitar players.
Yeah. Well, when I did Steve, like, it was me, Steve, and Cooch. And I remember Ken Green walked up to me and he said, big shout out, by the way, to Ken Green and what he's doing at Bogies. Yeah. But he said, man, that was great. And I said, you know, I have this kind of musical Hippocratic oath where it's like, first, do no harm. You know, like you know, it's like, I just want to, that's why I want to just wait. And if I have to jump forward, absolutely. But it's just not my personality. I'd much rather lay back in the cut and play that one part or that slide thing or that ambient thing or whatever to support what's happening and be that, you know, that third guitar player.
Yeah. No, but that's what it, I mean, that really is important. I mean, that support is what makes it's vital in a band situation. Even as and you functioning as a director.
Absolutely.
In situations, you got to support the rest of the musicians too.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, it's not, you know, you and then you're working with a singer like Josh.
Yep.
Your purpose is not to just thrash and shred.
Absolutely.
It's to make him look awesome and accent what you need to do to bring out the lyric, to bring out the voice.
Well, and I'll tell you a story about that. I mean, I don't want to, I feel like, you know, we could talk for hours, you know. But it's like with a good example of that for me was working with a Bette Midler band, because that was a large ensemble. Mm-hmm. It was like four horns, two keyboard players, drums, percussion, three background singers, two guitar players. And it was me and Jeff Pivar, who's another brother who I was so happy to do that with him. I love him with a deep, deep, deep passion. But you know, you have to find your space. And when you got two guitar players, that's a whole conversation of, you know, hey, how are we going to approach this?
Who's,
you know,
doing
so
what?
And sometimes it's as simple as you go low, I'll go high, you know, or if he's going to grab, you know, a 335, I'm going to grab a telly. Or if he's going to grab a steel string, I'll grab a nylon. Or, you know, me grabbing a banjo and being flexible and kind of going, how do we make this music? The same thing happened. I was doing a TV show with my buddy Michael Fish Herring. And it would literally be, you know, he would grab a nylon string and I would grab oud or banjo or or mandolin or something, and just find those things to make the music work from that perspective. But finding your holes and finding those spots. And sometimes, once again, it's a power trio, and that means you've got to be Eric Clapton. You've got to be,
you know, fill it up.
Yeah, you've got to be big and wide and take up your space. But other times, it's just playing two notes in the right spot.
Well, I'm going to play a clip, and this is
two notes in the right spot.
I was going to say, this is a lot more than two.
This is the opening for a song for Josh Groban. Mm-hmm. If I can say the name right,
Alahate. Yeah, I say Alejate, but it's Alahate.
Alahate. But it's what's interesting, two things. First of all, you're playing with the orchestra. You're soloing, but you're playing around. You can hear the orchestra. If you listen, you'll hear them kind of working in and around each other. The interplay is interesting. But the other really cool thing is you're using a blown-out guitar sound, which is Josh is known more for a traditional, you know.
Yes. And I'll tell you a story about this once every play.
All right, let me go ahead and play this clip. Yeah. This is great. Thank you. It's a beautiful.
Thank you.
And it's kind of, it's cool. I love the tone you're getting.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it. Well, it's funny. So a couple
sounds
of stories
like
about
Europa.
That. Yes. You know, so that was one of the things I was going to say. I had someone walk up to me. I said I just played in Mendocino recently, and I love it up there so much. It's such an incredibly artistic community. And it's incredible how much love and support people give to musicians and artists. We did the the music festival there last year. And someone walked up to me and they said, man, I hear Holdsworth and Hendrix and Jeff Beck and Carlos Santana.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of sat there going, yeah, that's about right. I mean, mm-hmm. in terms of not
your
only
influences,
my influences.
Yeah.
Yeah, but when this thing came up, so this song I typically play on nylon string, and it's kind of a nylon string feature. And Laura, you've come out and seen the show, so she knows
more
it's
than
like,
once.
Right? So she knows that it's like it's typically more of a kind of a classical guitar, Spanish kind of feature. But Josh had said before the last tour, he said, you know, why don't we take an electric approach? And we used to do this song called Pearls with Angelique Kidjoe, and I kind of would take the Carlos Santana role, and because it was Angelique and Carlos that did the record. And so he said, can you do kind of that Carlos thing? I was like, okay. And then I was thinking of, there's an album called Blues for Salvador that had these beautiful pads, and Carlos is playing kind of the soaring lead. But I couldn't help but have like my Larry Carlton and Jeff Beck stuff come out, because it's just part of my DNA. And when we were writing that intro, the chords became very adult. like the kinds of things where it was very, harmonically, it's really heavy. But I wanted to play in a way that felt very kind of earthy. You know, I wanted to play bluesy and melodic, but with this kind of more advanced harmony. And I co-wrote that with my buddy Dave DeLome,
mm-hmm.
who is probably one of the most frightening musicians. We were talking about another friend, Matt Rohde, earlier, but Dave's one of the most frightening musicians I've ever met. And his sense of harmony is so ridiculously advanced. Like, his parents had him transcribing Bill Evans, you know, when he was in junior high school. Yeah, he's just incredible. And he won't tell you. You'll see him, he's like, you know, got a leather jacket, driving like, you know, driving a big, you know, Suburban. But he's just an incredible, incredible guy, one of my best friends.
No, it's a great sound. It reminded me of, I heard a little David Gilmour.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Well, and I think that there's something about that, that's actually a great, great point, because there's something about that epic sound.
Yeah, that time, too.
Yeah, and especially when you're playing an arena and you've got an orchestra, you know, you got to go for it. But it's funny, because that thing, I have a buddy who always says, Tarek, you always seem to go for macho guitar tones. And I love that term. Just like, you know, and I think I do. I always gravitate toward these kinds of, you know, big, epic kind of things. Like these things that, you know, sometimes I want to feel like the sky is opening up and, you know, guitar player with a cape is coming in to save the day.
And a big white guitar.
Right, exactly, the big white guitar, exactly. I was saying, I have to come up with a name for this one, because I use this one so much these days. Yeah.
I'm going to play one more clip, and then I want to talk about your setup.
Yeah, okay, and I'll also tell you a little bit about that for that recording, because it's a little interesting.
For the
last one, but we can get back.
No, go ahead, because I'm going to, well, unless, I was going to play, if I can pronounce it right, Un Día.
Oh, Llegará, yes. Oh, so I'll tell you really quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because we'll get into what I'm using today. But that, on that recording for Josh, I have a rig that I use on the road that is, it's a wet-dry-wet rig, meaning mm-hmm. there's a center dry cabinet, and then effects are left and right. And the reason I do that with Josh, I've gone back and forth because it's a bit convoluted and you really have to trust your sound man. But the reason I do that is because in that environment, because everything is so stereo, like you've got stereo orchestra, stereo piano, stereo drums, you know, all this kind of stuff, that the best space for me is mono down the center. But a lot of stuff has to sound big and epic. So I send my effects to the left and right, and I have a rack, a small kind of 8-space rack that tours with me, where my cabinet gets mic'd. The microphone goes through a mic pre, goes through my effects, which include Eventide and Lexicon stuff, and then that gets spread left and right to the board. Then all my pedals go before the amplifier, meaning like all my gain-based stuff. So my gain-based stuff is typically before, and then my time-based stuff is after.
Oh,
so,
okay.
Yeah.
No, you can hear it in the recording, too. It,
yeah,
bouncing
yeah.
Bouncing around.
Yes, yes.
Now, this next clip that I'm going to play, it shows you're playing, if I'm correct, classical guitar. Mm-hmm. And it's aggressive.
Yes.
But it's cool. It works to what you're... Now, this one, I think there's... synth pads like behind.
Yes, and I think this is right before the orchestra actually comes in for the song. So yeah.
Right. So this I'll let you say the name again.
Un día llegará.
Okay, here we go. There it goes. It's a quick one. What is this?
Oh, we were saying this is off of Josh's record. I want to say this one's on Closer. Man, if I get this wrong.
We'll edit.
Yes. But this was, I want to say this one was written, it was co-written, but I want to say the person who wrote the lyrics, I want to say it was like an ex-girlfriend or ex-wife of Mel Gibson, but there's a weird story about how it all came together. But when you hear it with all the orchestration, it has that very kind of Russian, big, you know, grand kind of orchestral movement to it. So, yeah, I'll have to send you the whole track at some point.
Oh yeah, no, definitely. Are you playing fingers or pick?
So I was going to share this with you. So one of the stories I wanted to tell is, although I have studied classical guitar, for Josh, and when I'm playing with orchestra, I tend to play with a pick. And the reason I do is because it sticks out more with the orchestra, and it's kind of a Tommy Tedesco trick. But I remember I was doing, so way back in the day, once again, I love telling stories about my failures, but way back in the day when I first worked with Josh, my nylon string thing was not happening. And so the conversation came up of hiring a nylon string specialist, and then I would just play electric guitar.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so I basically said to the musical director at the time,
no.
Yeah, well, no, I said, you know, I'm not amenable, but I was like, give me a shot. Let me audition on it. Let me show you that I can do this.
Cool.
So, of course, I it's kind of my nature, but I was like, holy, I can't say what
it's
I want
to challenge.
Say, but holy
yes.
cow.
Holy challenge.
So, yeah, so let me put
holy
this together.
Holy nylon strings.
But I was lucky because I wound up doing a thing at the Hollywood Bowl with Josh, and I was sitting next to Paul Villapiano, who's an incredible musician, incredible guitar player. And Paul looked at me and he said, man, you got to play with a pick. And he said, playing with your fingers isn't going to make it in this environment. And he plays with the Hollywood Bowl Orchestra all the time. He was like, you know, it's great, you know, from an ego standpoint to be able to do that stuff. But really, in order for it to cut through and to really sit where you want it to sit, and it's actually the sound that the guys who are recording the pop records, like the Tommy Tedescos and the Dean Parks and the Ramon Stagnanos and you know, those guys, that's how they approach it. Mm. And so I realized that that was what was going to make it or break it for me. And there are a lot of people from the Josh world who kind of know me as a nylon string guy and don't even know the other part of me that, you know, plays in dark, dingy clubs late at night. For peanuts.
The secret is out.
Exactly. Shoot. Yes.
No, but I've heard that from other players.
Yeah.
Other flamenco and neoclassic, they use the pick live to cut through.
You kind of have to. There's a story of Tommy Tedesco doing a recording session with John Williams, and it might have been, was it the Deer Hunter? It could have. I think it was. I think it was Cavatina. And John Williams came in, you know, legit classical, whose enemy is just incredible. And Tommy, you know, was playing with the pick, and he felt, you know, he didn't want to, like, you know, let the cat out of the bag, so he put his music stand where you couldn't see his hand, you know, and he kind of cut it like that. And it's just, it's beautiful. But, and it can be a beautiful sound. You just have to be careful because it can be so pointed that figuring out how to make it, keep it sounding warm and keep it sounding lyrical can be a little tough, you know.
Now, what guitar were you using on that classical?
So that is a guitar I got from Yamaha. Mm-hmm. And I had, so I actually, when I was kind of upping my classical game, I wound up buying from my classical teacher this beautiful Marin flamenco guitar, you know. I mean, it was beautiful but fragile. And I was like, well, I need to get another nylon as a backup just in case. And I got this master-built Yamaha classical guitar and put an LR Bags pickup in it. And for what we were doing, it beat the other guitar. And so that's been my number one for years. And unfortunately, Yamaha stopped making it. So that guitar has a special Carlton case that protects it, because if it goes down, it's a bad day for everybody.
Oh, boy.
And it's funny. I've had moments where, like, you know, I was playing with Josh. I think we were doing, like, you know, some big, you know, arena or outdoor thing. And I was just playing the guitar, you know, and he looks at me and he goes, God, that sounds great. Are you using that with me? I was like, yes, for the past 10 years.
Well, let's talk a little bit now. Let's talk about this Strat, your pedal board, and this really cool amp.
Thank you. I'll start with the amp because I say that that amp is a giant killer. So basically what it is it's a Tweed Deluxe. Mm-hmm. And so I want to preface this by saying that I am a weirdo. And I'm a weirdo in that I never really thought I had a style for a long time. I always felt like my job was to sound like whomever I had to sound like at the time. So mm-hmm. it didn't really bother me. I didn't have an ego about it, but I didn't really feel like I had a perspective until I started working on a record back in 2005. I should have sent you some of those tracks.
Next time.
Yeah, exactly. Good point. But I started writing stuff and realizing that I really did have kind of a take on things. So I tend to come at stuff sometimes with a bit of an accent now, more so than I used to in the past. Mm-hmm. And my tends to be somewhat organic and, for lack of a better term, I like the idea of an old school, a lot of old school things, but using it in a contemporary setting. So having said that, this is basically a Tweed Deluxe, but it's made by my buddy Roy Blankenship, who's mm-hmm. made a number of my amps and does all my amp repairs and all that stuff. And, you know, he's our resident L.A. genius, you know. Mm-hmm. And this was his Fat Boy. And I'm so sorry I keep telling anecdotes, but just as a quick aside, this one in particular used to belong to the incredible Ross Bolton, who passed away a number of years ago. Yeah.
Say no more.
Yeah, and Ross was incredible, an incredible guy. I loved him dearly. And after he had passed, you know, this was an amplifier that Roy was like, I know you wanted one. I think, you know, Ross's family is going to sell this one. And I was like, absolutely. So this has become my number one. If you see me 9 times out of 10, I'll just bring this. And it's loud enough and big enough and warm enough to, like I was saying, I played in this giant band last night, and this one was all I used and cut through everybody.
Toshi, right now, do you know about this?
Yeah. Oh. Well, Toshi tends to love... He tends to love EL84 bass stuff, and this is 6V6 bass, so it's a little more kind of old school Fendery kind of 1950s technology.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't Ross his teacher though? I think so.
Well, Ross was Toshi's teacher. Well, that makes sense. That actually makes complete sense.
So you replaced him in triple scale.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Holy moly. Yeah. Well, this one right now I've barely even got it on. Like I think it's on like about 2. You can hear this like very warm. You know.
So beautiful.
And so that's what I was saying is, I can get it to sound contemporary, but there's a way that it reacts in the mid-range, the way it reacts to the guitar, and that's literally just volume, volume, tone. And so the way it all works together for me, I really respond to, and it also works with the way my hands work. And so,
what speaker's in there?
In this one, I want to say it's a...
Is it a Celestion?
Yes, it is. And is it a GH? It could be. I have to... And it is a special speaker that's in there. I just can't remember. I'll have to look at it before we take off. And then, so going to my guitar, because it's going to take less time to talk about, this is an interesting instrument because this has become one of my number one traveling guitars. And I have people that know me know that I tend to play James Tyler's guitars. Jim is an old buddy of mine. He makes some of the best instruments on the planet. I mean, I play a lot of, like, larger, you know, like semi-hollow bodies and, like, you know, White Falcons and all that stuff these days because the music calls for it. But I grew up as a kind of a Strat guy. I typically use James Tyler stuff, but I was getting ready to do some work with Brian McKnight, who I love dearly. Brian's incredible. But I knew that we were doing a lot of flying, and I didn't want to bring additional stuff and fly it under the plane, so I wanted to bring something that I knew if United Airlines got their hands on it, I wouldn't, you know...
Common theme here.
Yes, I knew I wouldn't, like, weep uncontrollably. You know, and I'm 6'5", and if, you know, if I'm weeping uncontrollably, I'm sure I'm going to get tased. So this is actually a Fender road-worn Stratocaster. I got this from Fender, and it never was quite right. It never sounded quite right to me. I wound up switching out the pickups to Sur V60 LPs, and I wound up taking it, when I knew I was going to use it as kind of my main guitar this past year, I wound up taking it to John Carruthers. And John, I just kind of started working with him, and he is just, he's a guru and like basically a Yoda of guitar repair. So he reshaped the neck, he put a different bridge on it, and he put some electronics in it. It's kind of the way a Strat is normally set up, where I've got, here, let me kick this off, the delay off, so you can hear. So it's basically got five positions, and the tone is wired to the bridge, which, you know, most people do, so that I can not only kind of roll it back for lead stuff and get more, you know, kind of a, you know, like a little bit more of a warm sound, but also, you know, you can do the old kind of Jeff Beck thing where you right. roll the tone off here and where I'm switching back the selector and rolling the tone off the volume so I can kind of do all the fun little Jeff Beck things. But then he also put, I tend to put something on the volume pot, so when I roll back the volume, it doesn't darken like traditional strats do. And last but not least, there's a push on the tone, the last tone position, that allows the bridge pickup to come on, so I can do all three pickups on for like some of those kind of 80 sounds and whatnot. So what I love about this guitar is that it allows me to get a more mid-range forward kind of old is the new kind of sound, you know, like a little more organic and whatnot, but I can still get some of those kind of glassy DI
sounds. when you have the neck pickup on and you pop that switch up, you basically get a Tele.
It's just, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And then if I go here, that gives me actually all three. Like, right. I just went to like one position back. I just realized that, you know, I'm talking out of the microphone so people can't see my hands.
No, but they... Yeah.
So one of the things I do, which is, you know, I kind of stole from Michael Thompson, but one of the things I do is in order to get that kind of 90s, you know, pop sound, what I'll do is I've got a fuzz, basically a germanium fuzz face on this pedal board, and I won't play it full volume. But instead of using it as a fuzz, sometimes I'll kick it on, and then I'll roll back the volume, and mm-hmm. what it does is this really glassy, kind of clean, almost DI.
And that's with the germanium?
Yeah, so germanium tends... has a tendency to do that. So if I kick on, I'm going to kick on my compressor in a little delay, I can get kind of that really almost kind of 90s. You know, I can kind of get that 90s thing, but I still am doing it with a tweed, like a 1950s technology essentially. And so I'll do that with a fuzz. And then with my pedal board, because it's a germanium fuzz and they react so differently, like wherever they are on the chain, mm-hmm. it's this one up here. It's actually a John Shanks, shout out to John. It's a Shanks 4 knob, which is basically a germanium based kind of fuzz face. So that's the first pedal in my chain, right? And then it goes through, I'm trying to think when it hits the buffer. I can't remember. Sorry. But
that's
so
okay.
So everything on here is kind of a combination of, you know, once again, old is the new. So a lot of it is based on like fuzz faces and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a fuzz face, basically. Basically, a Vox wah. Everybody knows what a wah wah sounds like if you've heard Shaft or Hendrix. And then this is my compressor, which is called a Cali 76 from Origin Effects.
Mm-hmm.
These guys are incredible. It's basically like a studio 1176 compressor in a pedal. So what I love about it is, so this is without it. Let me get the delay off. This is without it. That's with it. So it doesn't really have that. It doesn't really have like that super grabby sound, but it helps to kind of bring everything forward and sound a little more spanky. And what I love about it is with this one, and I've never really done this before, I can cascade it with overdrives and get a whole different overdrive sound than I would just by using gain for more sustain and whatnot. Am I running short on time, by the way? I'm a little worried.
You're getting there, but you're okay. Keep going.
So you're
on a roll.
All right. we can do
pedal
this.
Board,
yes, I'm going to have to speak more quickly. No, so it goes through that, which I love that compressor to death, and I love those guys. And they actually kind of put these together. They started almost trying to emulate Lowell George's sound with the cascading 1176s. So they've got one that's called the slide rig, which I have on another pedal board,
mm-hmm.
that trying to kind of emulates that Lowell George thing, and I'm a huge Little Feet fan, so of course I had to find
those
out.
1176s in the studio.
Man, it's so sweet. And the fact that I can put it on the board, I was worried that traveling as much as I do, it would just get hammered, and then suddenly one day it would just crap out. Hold on, knock on wood. You know, so then it goes into an EP booster
mm-hmm.
by Exotic. And basically what this is meant to be is essentially it is like plugging into an Echoplex and not turning on the delay. And so the Echoplex used to have a preamp in it that would warm up your sound to an extent. So this is my guitar without, or you know, this is basically my Strat into the deluxe.
Direct. Right. Direct in.
Yeah, and then that's with the.
Yeah, it gives it a little more body.
Yeah, a little more body, wakes it up, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that's on all the time, and literally, it's turned all the way off, and I just kick it on just for a little chicken grease. and then the next one in line is another. So the John Shanks pedal is from Vemuram, mm-hmm. which is a Japanese company. And big shout out there. They make some of my favorite pedals right now. Because I feel like they have kind of an old school aesthetic. But John Shanks has his pedals made from them. And Daryl Jones has pedals made from them. And Oz Noy and all those guys. Did you see Oz the other night, by the way? Oh, he's incredible.
I promoted that show.
Oh, yeah. I've known Oz for many a moon.
I know all of the other guys, and he's not from here.
No,
so.
No, he's not from this planet.
We had it was an awesome show. Yeah.
Well, so this is basically right now. In fact, let me kick this one. So right now, I'm running through just the EP booster, and I just put a little slapback on. And this is kind of my friendly neighborhood slapback. This is like, you know.
That's like, the timeline, right?
Yeah.
Bruce Dryman.
Yeah. And so this one is the January. And as soon as I heard this pedal, I fell in love with it. Found out the cost, and I was like, oh, God, are you kidding me? But I couldn't help it, and now I've got one on every pedal board. And basically what it is to me is it's like with a lot of blackface amps, there's kind of a magic number at somewhere around 6 where they start to kind of fold over, and there's this juicy kind of low-end thing. And that's what this does. So I use this actually a lot of times for that. So I'll use that for like that kind of, you know, Keith Richards thing.
That's great.
Man, and for that front pickup. It's got that.
Yeah, it just sounds like the amps.
Yeah,
like
it sounds
6.
Like a, it literally sounds like a black face that's like, you know, like a basement that's just kind of starting to crank up. And then the next one to the line, this is my, more than probably any other pedal, this has become kind of, I don't want to call it my signature. My buddy Greg Walton has this company, which is Exact Tone Solutions. Mm-hmm. And they make a precision overdrive, multi-drive and a precision overdrive. And I have one on every pedal board and in every rig. And I realized probably in two years ago that more than any other pedal, that's probably kind of my sound, for lack of a better term. It's basically his take on, don't kill me, Greg, basically his take on a tube screamer. And I know it's a weird kind of macho thing of mine, but for some reason I had this thing of, you know, we as guitar players tend to get so obsessed with gear. And we get so obsessed with changing stuff. But I was like, you know what? Part of your personality becomes becoming comfortable with something and knowing what it does. So having that thing that might not be, quote unquote, perfect, you start to learn how to play it so it's perfect for you. Mm-hmm. And this pedal is more than any other pedal become kind of my, you know, if I got to fight you, me and that, and we can do it, you know. And so it's basically, it's a little dark sounding because I have the amp turned down so much. But it's basically like a really kind of like
it's a great distortion.
Yeah, it's the character of the distortion is really beautiful. In fact, I can hold on. Let me brighten up just a little for you. And so for me, I love that kind of fresh cream, Eric Clapton kind of, you know, that.
Well, the thing that's interesting is it gets that kind of thump that when you push the tube.
Yes.
And
yes.
I usually lose that on most pedals. And
well,
it gets that.
And I think that thing, like, I used to go to sleep to Wheels of Fire, a Cream Wheels of Fire. And so that sound of, like, Eric Clapton with the 335 with the Marshalls.
Right.
And that,
right,
like. Like, that was something that really appealed to me. So that, for me, is my, once again, more than any other pedal, is my kind of, you know, if you see a pedal board, it probably has that on it.
It's your pet.
It's my pet, yeah.
Pet pedal.
We're out of time.
Oh, shoot. Okay.
But real quick.
Yeah.
Just, he has a timeline and an Eventide effects.
Yes, I've got a timeline on here. I've got my Eventide H9, which I use for multi-effects. A Flint, which is the best tremolo reverb I've ever heard. And then I've got this Boss EQ I just put on here that is my new gig saver. So, yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Now, real quick,
yeah.
Where are you playing so
oh,
people
gosh.
Can hear you? Because you're doing a lot of different things.
I am. Okay, so really quickly, as I said earlier, I'm doing this Groove Lounge gig every other Thursday. And it's just something for some of us to do for fun. But we've got incredible singers joining us. This next one, we have...
March 1st.
Actually, we're not doing March 1st.
Not March 1st.
No. We're going to do March 15th. And it's Jason Scheff from formerly.
Didn't I see a flyer for March 1st?
Yes, but we had to. We actually
been retracted. Yes. Facebook people.
I know, but I promise we're doing it March 15th, and it's Jason Scheff and me and James Hare on guitars. Mm-hmm. And then the next one we're doing is Monet Evans from Boss Gags Band is going to sing with us. Mm-hmm. And the one after that is Melanie Taylor.
Yeah,
so it's all these
Melanie.
World famous singers coming in and special guesting. And then I'm also just getting ready to start a series called Underground Sounds in Santa Barbara at Wine Therapy. And it's literally just me with a trio with Randy Tico and Mario Caleri from Ozomatli and the Wallflowers.
Nice.
And we're using it as a venue to actually promote local talent. So
nice.
Different singer-songwriters are going to come up with us once a month.
Randy plays in Rosemary's Band, too.
Yes, Randy's one of the baddest on the planet.
Yeah, it's so great.
But my thing is wanting also to give back to the community and play in these situations where in Ventura and Santa Barbara and kind of help local businesses and help local artists. Because I think sometimes it's hard to get Santa Barbarians out and Ventura people out to really kind of support, you know, and especially with the fires and mudslides, so many businesses were affected. Mm-hmm. So the more we can get people out to check this stuff out,
yeah.
the better.
Isn't there a big show coming?
There was just last night.
Yeah, yes. Wilson Phillips was at. And all.
Yes.
I thought there was one at, like, beginning of March also.
There is. There's another one coming up,
Maitland.
And a lot of people. Because
yeah.
Kenny is doing another
Kenny's
one.
Kenny's doing one.
Yeah, so
Maitland's
Kenny Loggins,
one.
I should
yeah.
say, yeah.
Kenny Loggins,
yes. I say Kenny even though I barely know him. But I think it's that's something that's really important and close to my
yes.
heart, and also trying to lift up the community and trying to bring these world-class talents to the area. So.
Yes, and well, next time you have to come back.
Yeah,
obviously.
I would love to, and I'm sorry that we ran out of time.
No, it was great. But I also wanted to, next time, too, also, besides you sending me all the stuff that
yes,
you're talking
sorry.
About. No, that's cool. But I also want to talk about a lot of the stuff that you've done for education, because I
yeah.
think that's very important. And I want to stress again that he's, you know, he's written these books and he's been the chairman of the guitar department. So education is a very important thing to him. And I think that's amazing.
I would love to. Maybe the next time we'll do a whole thing on, we can do it on education and pedagogy and all,
ooh,
you know,
yes.
show some stuff on the guitar and all that stuff.
Which was
yes.
the school that you had with Lawrence Duber last
oh.
year? You brought the school people.
They were from the LA school district through
oh, cool.
Guitars in the Classroom.
Man,
so
that's
with Jessica Barron. And then also, too, real quick.
Tomorrow, Buzz Wizards.
Yes, Toshi.
Toshi,
yes.
who was just on the show.
My homie.
And Steve Ferroni is going to be on that again,
yes,
on drums.
Yes.
And
if you guys come down, I'm coming down. It's
Jorgen.
A rare moment.
All right.
I'll be giving out. Come and say hi.
Matt Rohde.
Yes, Matt Rohde, one of the best in the business.
And then there's
and,
a couple other gigs.
At the Baked Potato
yeah.
tomorrow, 9
at
o'clock.
At the Baked Potato. But there's two other things.
We got the Dr. Wu Band playing at Bogey's
yeah.
on Sunday. That's a Steely Dan tribute. I'm going to be in it, too. Yay. And the following week is Elton John's Goodbye Yellow Brick Road with the Tribe.
I
at Bogey's. Yeah.
I'm
going to
take
down.
Us out with Glory Bound. Anything you want to say about that real quick?
So this was a project that I worked on and produced for my buddy Sean Jones,
mm-hmm.
who ironically is a Ventura and Central Coast musician and unbelievable and fantastic, and I love him dearly.
And a lefty like us.
And a lefty, yes. And so this was a project he wanted to do an acoustic record that was something different from some of his more electric projects. So I hope you enjoy.
Yes, and also, too, for more information, Tariq.com is where to find out what he's doing and,
yeah.
and some cool pictures of some great guitars.
Thank you. And if I may, my name is spelled Tariqh. It's so different that everyone will go to Tariqh and get it wrong. But it's Tariqh.com.
Okay, so here's Glory Bound. Everybody, thank you for listening, and thank you for coming on the show. It's
my
a pleasure.
Pleasure.
And thank you, Lori, of course, of
you're
putting this
welcome.
Whole thing together. We will see you next week, but this is Glory Bound. Have a great week.
I'm gonna buy me a driver. I'm taking a full ride. Gonna head out on that highway with nothing but my pride, oh Lord. Yeah, got nothing but my pride. I won't be turning back, no, until I reach the other side, the other side, yeah.
turning, we're all hanging upside down. It's gonna take a lot more than gravity to keep me hanging round, yeah. You can't keep me hanging round. Oh, no, no. Well, that night wind is calling. I believe I'm glory bound. Yeah, that night wind is calling, Lord. I believe I'm glory bound. I believe I'm glory bound.